As president of the National Press Club, I must inform our guest speaker at the outset that I have no intention of stepping down, no matter what she says about me today. Before she takes the podium, however, I wish to assure her that I will do everything in my power to protect the National Press Club scrip, our in-house currency, from being emasculated in the maw of a single European currency unit. After all, how would that sound? An NPCECU? You can't do it. Moreover, I promise you, I have not, and I will not, sign the Treaty of Maastricht. In contrast to the present Prime Minister of Great Britain, I definitely am not persuadable. Now, if that doesn't earn me a favorable review, I don't know what will. Let us hope that our guest will also comment on Prime Minister John Major's latest move to solidify his position as leader of Britain's Conservative Party. Margaret Thatcher has not been hesitant to assess Mr. Major's performance up to now. As she's been telling interviewers recently, Mr. Major was elected to continue Lady Thatcher's policy and instead has blurred them beyond recognition. In particular, Lady Thatcher's no, no, no to submerging Britain in the swamp of European integration has become yes, yes, yes under Mr. Major. Mr. Major's popularity, it should be noted, is the lowest for any British Prime Minister in the post-World War II era. Lady Thatcher, on the other hand, is enjoying renewed acclaim for the second volume of her memoirs, entitled The Path to Power. She is here in the United States to promote the book. It is not hyperbole to describe Lady Thatcher as one of the great world leaders of our time. A resident of 10 Downing Street for 11 and a half years, she holds the record as Britain's longest serving prime minister in this century, stepping down in 1990. The daughter of a shopkeeper, Margaret Hilda Roberts studied in the family's flat above the store. She learned politics from her father, won a scholarship to and graduated from Oxford University, where she was president of the Conservative Association. Her political career has been phenomenal. She was elected to Parliament in 1961 and served in ministerial appointments. Then she was elected leader of the Conservative Party and, in 1979, was elected Britain's first woman prime minister. In 1992, she became the Baroness of Kesteven. Lady Thatcher is married to Dennis Thatcher. They are parents of twins, Mark and Carol. A woman of keen wit, intelligence, and political instinct, Lady Thatcher personifies the democratic ideal of the person who rises to the top from modest origins. Now she has the time and desire to talk about her life and times. And as special guests today, we have a group of students and faculty from George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. A warm welcome, please, for Lady Margaret Thatcher.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. President, I think you've already said most of it, and I could quite easily move on to questions which I would answer or adroitly avoid. But perhaps I will first stick to the script, what I had intended to say. It won't include in the script references to this week's or to this day's events, but I thought I'd leave you something to ask questions about. Now, as every journalist knows, there's no better way to clarify your own thoughts than to try to explain yourself to someone else. I found this, too, in writing the latest volume of my memoirs, The Path to Power. This covers my early life in the small town of Grantham, my time as a Member of Parliament, as a member of the Shadow Cabinet, which we have when we're in opposition, under the actual cabinet, which we have when we're in power, and then as leader of the opposition. In fact, the whole period up to my becoming Prime Minister in 1979. And as I had always intended, I have added 4 more chapters about the world and the future as I see it now. It's about that second section of the book and the ideas that it contains that I want really to speak mainly today. But first I'd like to say something of the influences which shaped my views and made me the kind of politician I became. I grew up against a loving but strict family background in a small town. We were a hard-working family, and my father was a successful grocer. We were Methodists, and religion was a very strong influence in our lives. But so also was politics. My father would, in earlier years, probably have been a Liberal Party voter. But that was when the Liberals stood for small government and private enterprise economics, and that was some time ago. For as long as I remember, our family was true blue Tory, rather the exception in non-conformist circles at that time. Every week, my father and I would borrow books on political subjects from the local library. We read the newspapers and discussed what they said. When the radio came in, called a wireless in those days, that was almost as much the center of our lives as Finkin Street Methodist Church, because it enabled us to listen to the speeches and the debates of great people. I learned a very great deal from my father. I will just tell you 2 things. I once asked him if I could go out with my friends for a walk on a Sunday evening, instead of going to church, because I'd been to church once and Sunday school twice. And he said, never do things just because other people do them. You make up your mind what you want to do and let the crowd follow you. I went to church. And then another time when I had started many things, as you do when you're young, and I had got fed up, rather bored with one task, and I was told very firmly, very quickly, it's easy enough to start a job, but are you a sticker too? It's easy enough to begin your work, it's harder to see it through. And so I was always taught, if you start something, persevere until it be well and truly finished. So you see the message, and it pursued me all through my political life. Make up your own idea about what you believe and want to do, and then pursue it fervently until you have achieved your true purpose. So when I got into government, I never did a U-turn. But it was, of course, the war years which most affected my wider outlook on events. Just as some people saw the 30s as proof that only the state could manage economic progress, so others saw the war as proof that nationalism was the ultimate threat to peace, and so nationhood must be suppressed. For my family, with our patriotic belief in Britain, that was absurd. It was not the nation, but the government which had failed. Failed because it had not stood up to aggression at an early stage, but had appeased it. The remarkable oratory of Winston Churchill was now indelibly imprinted on my mind. I believed then, and I believe now, that the principle that aggression must not be allowed to pay is fundamental to a just and orderly world. These were the events and people who shaped my early years and my fundamental beliefs. But there was another person who was instrumental in guiding my political thoughts, Keith Joseph, who has just died. I had known Keith for many years. Indeed, our paths had crossed very soon after I entered Parliament as an MP for Finchley in 1959. And we built up a friendship and rapport which remained firm to the end. In 1970, we found ourselves together as cabinet colleagues in Ted Heath's government. The events of 1970 to 1974, that particular government, for which as a member of that cabinet I must take my share of the blame, were a marvelous demonstration of how not to govern. They taught me three important lessons. First, it's by control of the monetary cause of inflation, not the prices and wages which are but symptoms of it, that you attain financial stability. Second, income policies lead to confrontation with wage bargainers which government cannot win. And thirdly, when you set out to tame trade union militancy, you have to choose your own ground and your own timing. Don't rely on appeals to common sense or common interest to see you through. They won't. In 1974, after we had lost the election, Keith started to set out a real conservative analysis. He said that for 30 years, under governments of both parties, we had been moving in the wrong direction, towards too much state spending, too much borrowing, too much taxation and regulation, and too little incentive for enterprise. I joined him in the Center for Policy Studies, which we set up, and where he advanced a new approach, or rather, an old approach whose merits had been forgotten, an approach of limited government, individual freedom, private property ownership, and a rule of law. You'll notice it has echoes of Ronald Reagan's marvelous phrase, "We limit government in order to liberate the talents and energies of the people." One unfortunate speech sunk Keith's chances of becoming leader of our party. It was one in which he'd referred to social groups D and E and the number of children they had. And the moment I saw the banner headlines, I knew we were in trouble. And Keith, after 4 days, came along to my study in the House of Commons. He'd rung to say, could he come and see me about something important? He arrived and he said, "I want to tell you, we've had the press outside, camped outside our house for 4 days and nights. The family and I cannot take it, and we have decided I cannot run for the leadership of the party." And I went to protest, because you have to endure these things. And he said, "Don't try to persuade me. We've jointly made the decision." It was a terrific blow, because I think we were the two architects of the real conservative philosophy and its renewal. And I heard myself saying, "Well, Keith, if you won't stand, I must, because someone who believes in our views must put themselves up to be leader of the party." I went home that night, Dennis was at home, and said, rather abruptly, I fear, because it filled my mind, "I've agreed to stand as leader of our party." He said, "What? Good God, you must be mad. You haven't a hope." Well, I didn't agree that I was mad, but I did think that the assessment that I hadn't a hope was probably correct. But not for the first time, I was wrong. And so, I had put my name forward to challenge Ted Heath for the leadership, and I thought it would trigger the names of many of my other colleagues. I fought my campaign on the themes that I've indicated and on the fundamental principles in which we believed. And to the shocked disbelief of the Conservative Party hierarchy, I won. By now, my own intellectual and moral approach to politics was more or less complete. I knew what I believed, I knew the policies which flowed from it, and I knew where I stood, and I knew for my father never to falter. That said, the experience, often turbulent and troubled, of leading the Conservatives in opposition was immensely useful. I presided over a deeply split shadow cabinet in which those I might call the true believers, who shared Keith's and my analysis, were always a minority. I learned a great deal about tactics and about campaigning. Yet it was only in the so-called winter of discontent, when Britain ground to a halt through waves of strikes in the winter of 1978-79, that I managed then to seize the initiative with policies I'd already worked out and commit the Conservative Party to the kind of policies which I knew were necessary. The argument about trade union reform, about the economic policy, would have to be won time after time against the unconvinced in my own shadow cabinet and later in my cabinet over the years. Even during the 1979 election campaign, an attempt was made to muzzle me for fear that I would sound too radical and provocative in my attacks on socialism and on union militancy. But in May that year, we won a solid election victory, a 45 majority over all other parties combined. And I was given the chance, my only chance, to put things right. Nowadays, my friends, the 1980s receive what might politely be called mixed reviews. But I believe that when the historians get down to their serious work, perhaps sometime after I have stopped mine, that they will judge that decade in both our countries very favorably. Both Ronald Reagan and I deliberately set out to reverse state control, to liberate individual initiative, and stand up to a Soviet empire, which was every bit as evil as he described it, and a great deal more serious threat to our way of life than today's revisionists pretend. His main task lay in foreign and defense policy, which was only natural for a superpower. My main task was in economic affairs, to roll back collectivism in all its forms. But our starting point was very similar. And I'm glad to note that the fashion for disparaging the Reagan years has passed, and that today's Republicans are trying to build on Reaganism and not to bury it. I suspect that something similar is about to happen in my own country. But just at the moment, discretion forbids my enlarging on that point. Although I expect to be questioned about it. That, however, does not prevent me, 16 years after entering Downing Street and 4.5 years after leaving it, from setting out from the perspective of that experience some thoughts about the future. I offer them to encourage and I hope to stimulate the next generation of political leaders in different countries, including my own. When I left office, there was more than a touch of complacency in the West. The Cold War had been more or less won. And especially after the outcome of the Gulf War, the talk was of new world orders and of peace dividends. My friends, there will never be a new world order. And there was a renewed tendency for governments to believe they could spend their way out of political problems at home at the expense of defense capabilities for action abroad, a tendency which is still with us. For Britain, the emphasis was on consensus, not confrontation. And I'm reminded about what I said about consensus last time I was here. The consensus was the negation of leadership. And I remember an occasion when I was sitting with fellow heads of state and government in a Commonwealth conference and trying to draft a communique which reflected what we'd decided, and I was trying to make it hard and concrete and express a course of action. And all of a sudden, Forbes Burnham said to me, "We can't have that. We want consensus." And I said, "Now tell me, what do you mean by consensus?" He said, "Something that none of us want, but which we can all live with." I thought that summed it up very well, and I would have nothing to do with it, so someone else had to write that communique. The emphasis still is on consensus, particularly as regards our relations with the increasingly federalist European community. Many of these chickens about increased spending, about cutting defense, and about the problems of the European community, many of these chickens have now well and truly come home to roost. A shameful failure of the West to prevent or reverse aggression in the former Yugoslavia, in particular Bosnia, has discredited and divided us. The new Russia shows more and more signs of behaving like the old Soviet Union, as in Chechnya. The dependency culture continues to absorb more and more resources from fewer and fewer people active in the workforce. What is to be done? Let me take Europe first. As someone who believes in Britain, in our identity and our institutions, our history and our destiny, I reject the notion that we should effectively cease to govern ourselves and pass more and more powers over to European institutions and non-elected bureaucracies. I also take this opportunity to warn the people of the United States, as I have done on other occasions, that the agenda which the European Federalists have set can't be pursued without damaging American interests and ultimately jeopardizing harmonious international relations. It is only by staying united that the West, that is America and Europe together, can ensure that we are the dominant influence in global affairs. And that matters because we are the authors and spreaders of liberty and a rule of law. And that must be our goal. The European Federalists, who still find much support among European politicians, though less among European peoples, aim to create a United States of Europe with its own government, currency, foreign policy, and defense forces, which can only be and is intended to be a rival to the United States. I don't believe you can create one nation from 15 different countries with 15 different histories and 13 different languages. So I propose that Britain first negotiates its way out of those aspects of the present financial arrangements with Europe, which bear particularly heavily upon Britain, that we act to protect our parliamentary and legal sovereignty, that we declare openly against a single currency, and that we urge the creation of a North Atlantic free trade area covering North America and the European Community, which would underpin NATO and reverse European protectionism. That leads directly onto my second point, wider international affairs, what I call the New World Disorder. There is, I know, a lively debate in the United States about the scope and purpose of international interventions. That is as it should be. For recent experience in Somalia and ex-Yugoslavia suggests that much is wrong. The danger is that an over-ambitious policy, conceived in the wake of the Gulf War and of the Cold War, has led to such comprehensive failure that there will be a reaction against overseas military involvement of any kind. Unlike some other conservatives, I do believe that it is right to consult moral principles, particularly human rights, and not only a restrictive view of the national interest when making decisions about intervention. But I also believe that even in the most tragic circumstances, it is necessary to be strictly practical. In some cases, probably like Somalia, there is little that outside intervention can accomplish when conducted by states. And the best thing is to wait until conditions are achieved locally for humanitarian work by international agencies. But in other cases, I think above all of Bosnia, moral principles both coincide with wider geopolitical interests and can be implemented by effective military means. We should and could have stopped the Serb aggressor in 1991 in Croatia and in 1992 in Bosnia before the situation got out of control. I was always against the sending of ground troops, and I was in favor of lifting the arms embargo on Croatia and Bosnia, supplying them with arms and with training, and then letting them do the fighting because they know the terrain and people fight wonderfully for their own country, and use massive air power to force Serb compliance with United Nations resolutions relating to humanitarian aid to civilians and relating to the safe areas which we created. This is still the policy to which we have to return, though perhaps with some greater role for ground forces since we created safe areas in the short term, mainly to protect our people on the ground. Another era of the false internationalism which has done so much damage is the tendency to disparage nations, nationhood, and national sovereignty. Nationalism, as long as it is accompanied by democracy and respect for human rights, is generally a force for durable and flexible stability in world affairs. Without strong nation states, dictators and aggressors cannot be defeated. United Nations resolutions don't do the fighting. It's nation states that do, and do it effectively. And it was a multinational force that went to the Gulf under the leadership of the United States and with Britain as her first lieutenant and also with France and then with others. The day of great empires is past. And there's no point and as much danger in trying to recreate them, whether in a European superstate of different nations or a resurgent Russian empire. In our century, all empires have collapsed, whether they were the British, the French, the Dutch, the German, the Austro-Hungarian, the Turkish, or whether in this later part of this century they were the Soviet Union, which was a communist empire. All empires have collapsed, and we've come to the nation state, which of course the United Nations is an organization of nation states. I would say that defense has been cut back too far in our Western countries, combined with a lack of resolution among some Western leaders. This is giving the wrong signs to dubious political figures in the ex-communist world and dangerous exponents of force in the Islamic world. My third point, this is not unconnected with the social malaise that is affecting our countries, where we see family breakdown, growing illegitimacy, rising crime, and a huge dependency culture. A society which puts a higher value on state handouts to its able-bodied citizens than on measures to protect those citizens from internal crime and external threats is one which risks becoming decadent. And such decadence is itself a standing invitation to other states, more barbarous but also more self-confident than us, to chance their luck. We have to get our priorities in taxation, in spending programs, and in wider social policy back in line. We have to support families, not penalize them. And we have to deter irresponsible behavior, like never married single parenthood, not reward it. Finally, and fourthly, I want us to renew our faith in free market economics as the very best route to prosperity and progress. Of course I accept that social and cultural factors are important too. But the stark contrast between countries which embrace free enterprise capitalism and those which reject it must never be disguised or forgotten. Perhaps the two best examples are, first, the one between Hong Kong and China. Hong Kong has 6 million Chinese people, most of whom came from China. As you know, it's been under British rule for a long time. Sound administration, a rule of law, capitalism and free enterprise economics, and a partial democracy as much as we could get. Hong Kong from nothing, with no resources, but under that free enterprise, free society, has built herself up to one of the richest countries in the world. The average income there is $22,000 per head. Starting with nothing, with the right political system founded on liberty and capitalism. China, 1.2 billion people, on central planning and communist control with no liberty, poverty-stricken, with no dignity and no standard of living, until Dong is now releasing up, making a modest measure towards capitalism. And the other example, if anyone should think that countries are rich according to natural resources, that is not so. The richest country in the world on natural resources is Russia. But she has not been able to develop those because communism has stultified enterprise, talent, and ability. She has oil, she has gas, she has diamonds, she has platinum, she has gold, she has silver, she has all of the industrial minerals, she has marvelous timber, she has wonderful soil. And communism made a mess of it, both in economic terms, and of course, is one of the cruelest, was one of the cruelest nations in the numbers of people it massacred. The person called Professor Rummel, who's done a study this century of the number of people who have been massacred not by war, but by totalitarian regimes. The figure is 117 million people under totalitarian regimes, of which 95 million people have been massacred under communism. Now you see why we have a passion to extend liberty and law to the world. So, what we have to do now is to apply the wisdom of the market to places like sub-Saharan Africa, where too often state planning and controls keep the people impoverished. And we must hold our markets open to the goods and services of developing countries, not least because as they develop, they'll provide new markets for our goods and services. And if they can't sell to us, they have no money to buy from us. So, my friends, in spite of the problems and uncertainties, this is an exciting time to be alive, and nowhere more exciting than in the United States. Unlike previous generations, we have no excuses. We now know what political system works and what does not. We know what deters aggression, its strong defense and the latest technological weapons, and what invites it, which is weak defense. We know which vision inspires and which enslaves. The great questions of political, social, and economic life have received their answer. The open question now is whether we have the courage and resolve to apply it. Thank you.
Now the questions. Your former aide, John Redwood, is now challenging John Major for the leadership of the Tory Party. Whom do you support and why?
I thought that would be your first question, so I thought about it. First, I dislike this particular system of testing the leadership. It is comparatively new. It was invented when we were in opposition. It is quite wrong, in my view, that the Prime Minister should be able to be brought down by the members of Parliament, Conservative members of Parliament, who happened to be in the House of Commons at that time. A Prime Minister is answerable constitutionally to Parliament as a whole, through a vote of confidence, and to the people in an election. And it is wrong, in my view, that he or she could be changed by the device of having a leadership of the party election just among Conservative MPs. And I think people are beginning to realize now that that can destabilize the country as well as the party, and I hope we shall change it. I had to endure it, and it unsettles people every November because that's the time when it can be used. And this time, therefore, the Prime Minister brought it forward. But once he'd said, given the invitation to everyone, look, put up or shut up. You can't shut up MPs any more than you can shut up ex-MPs or ex-Prime Ministers. So some of them have taken the invitation to put up. And there'll probably be more because the lists are not closed until next Thursday. You know, Thatcher's law of politics has always been the unexpected happens. It happened in my life, it's happening now. So it's not surprising that there has been someone who has put up because Mr. Major invited people to put up. Now, John Redwood is very able. He was for 3 years the head of my policy unit in Downing Street. Between the years 1984, 1985, and 1986. He's very able indeed. He is very articulate. He came into Parliament in 1987. He has been a member of Cabinet from which he's just resigned. It's very unusual to get a Cabinet post as quickly, from 1987 to about 1993, and he became Secretary of State for Wales. Now, there will probably be other people, but usually on this first round, we get what's called a stalking horse, someone who you never expect to elect, but who is not a heavyweight person. John, of course, is a heavyweight personality. And so we don't quite know how many others will come in. What to me is important is that this is not an election of personalities and should not be. But the result must be that we must have the true Conservative policies which I pursued, which I've described to you, and which are well known. Policies of lower taxes, keeping our national and parliamentary sovereignty and the independence of the pound sterling. And it's important that we have a candidate that wins, that pursues those policies. And it's also important, therefore, that in this curious situation of this election, we do not get a third candidate scraping in from the left field who dilutes those policies and doesn't pursue them. So that's my interest. See, the candidate who wins pursues the policies that have been so successful and put Britain back on the map of the world and made her an influence once again. And it won't necessarily be only the two of them. It could be more. And then the first round, if there's to be no other, the leading candidate has to have not only a majority over the others, but a majority of 15% more than his nearest opponent. So it's quite difficult to win in the first round, and then you get a second round and more people will come in. So you can see it's quite difficult for politics to be in limbo during this time. And I will do my best to see that we don't have this rather curious election again.
Is this an endorsement of Mr. Redwood?
Both candidates are sound Conservatives. Next question.
Looking beyond the current situation, do you see any, quote, exciting new faces, unquote, among the Conservatives that may come to prominence in the next year or two?
Yes, there are a whole group in Cabinet who, again, are very strong Conservatives. They're in the John Redwood group. They were always with me. There's Peter Lilly, there's Michael Portillo, and I won't go on to say other names, but there are several others as well who are strong Conservatives. And I said I always had to have a kind of minority for my true policies in Cabinet. Some people tend to be faint-hearted if you're putting forward something that's going to be difficult. Change is always difficult, but you are there not just to limp along, but to bring the very best out of your people and to challenge them to do so. So yes, we've got some more.
All right. Would you be willing to follow in the footsteps of Mr. Churchill's remarkable odyssey and seek to reclaim the prime ministership yourself someday to save the nation?
No, I don't think that you should ever try to go back. Under Winston's circumstances, he came forward during wartime in 1940 to 1945. I was horrified. I remember the day very well when he was not elected. And that meant for the sake of his own pride, he had to come back and be elected by the British people, which he did in 1951. For the man who perhaps did more for Britain than any other prime minister, not to be elected by the people during part of his prime ministership would have been unthinkable. I was elected 3 times and never defeated. And I think far too many people would say, oh, it's time the old girl went, you know, so I went. They really don't think they'd want the old girl back, but the old girl really can shout things from the sidelines, you know. Thank you very much.
Considering the recent Labour electoral victories, what do you see as the future of the Conservative Party? And what is your opinion of Tony Blair on the other side?
The Conservative Party is the longest standing party in our history and will have a great future, provided it keeps to truly conservative policies. It's very ironic that Mr. Blair, who now leads the Labour Party, is saying that he agrees with quite a lot of the policies which I introduced, but I can assure you that he and the Labour Party fought me tooth and nail on those policies the whole time. The things they now agree with wouldn't exist but for conservative policies implemented against a lot of opposition. Mr. Blair is very able. You don't have to agree with all a person's policies to know that he is able and to like and admire the way he does things. I believe that there are still substantial socialist policies behind him, and he is all, of course, for passing over more powers to Europe. Now, I don't think we fought a war for parliamentary democracy only to pass over a lot of our powers to a Brussels bureaucracy, nor to pass over a lot of our legal powers from the British courts to a European court which can override ours. Mr. Blair and the Labour Party want to pass over more powers in that respect, and they want to have to join a European Social Charter whose outstanding characteristic is it loads more and more costs on employers, which is why many European goods are becoming too expensive and why Europe is putting up a protectionist ring to the outside world, which is wrong. So I think the Labour Party would go totally in the wrong direction as far as Europe is concerned. And also, undoubtedly, every time you hear them speak or hear the trade unions speak, they want an extra expenditure from the state on some particular thing and therefore going in totally the wrong direction. We do not want more state expenditure. The countries which are most successful, which are your own and Japan, most successful economically, take the lowest proportion of the national income and put it to expenditure by the state. You and Japan take about 34% of the gross national income to the state. In Britain, it's now about 42%. I got it down to 37, 38. In Europe, it's mostly above 50%. In Denmark, it's over, and Scandinavian countries, it's over 60%. In Sweden, it was about 68%. And I've always thought that once you get over to about the middle 40s, you start to come up to 50%, your country is becoming to come unfree if half of its national income is going to expenditure by the state. And undoubtedly, the Labour Party would put up the proportion that's spent by the state. One has to remember that every dollar or every $100 you take out of people's pockets to be spent by the state is $100 less for spending on your own family or your own home. So I like Mr. Blair, I admire him, he's very able. But the policies I hope the British people will utterly reject. I'll just give you one final figure. When I came into office after socialism in 1979, the top rate of income tax on earned income was 83%. The top rate of tax on savings income was 98%. We got them both down to 40%, but it was with great effort, and you had to get your public spending down. So you see now why I'm a devoted conservative politician, and I believe people will look at the policies, and I believe that if they do, they will return us for a further period of office.
You mentioned the shameful failure of the West to prevent aggression in Bosnia. What is your opinion of President Clinton as a world leader and American foreign policy, not only beyond Bosnia, but in Ireland and...